recorded.
This is an unrehearsed interview with Mr. Sidney Boone of Mason County, Kentucky, on August the 1st, 1988. The interviewer is Lynn David.
It's got a great big wall and sack.
Oh.
But it's got a tube out or something.
Well, this tape recorder, the Oral History Commission, has loaned to me to do these. Sidney, you were raised in Mason County, or were you raised in another county?
No, I was born in Richmond, Kentucky.
Oh, you were born in Richmond.
Yes.
And what was your dad's name?
My father was Orville Marshall Boone. My mother was Hetty Beatrice Boone. Williams. And the Williams family was from Madison County. And how this came about, my mother attended Eastern State University, which at that time was called the Normal School. That was previous to the name of Eastern Kentucky University. And Mrs. Yancey, who was superintendent of Mason County Schools at that time, sent a letter offering my mother a job in a very fine position in Mason County. When she got down here, it was way out on Pleasant Ridge in a little old one-room school, all run down. She took one look at it, and she says, "You didn't tell me the truth about this." She says, "I'm not interested." And she said, "Well, just give it second consideration. You'll find these people are very cooperative." So they had a meeting, and all the people came, and they promised to fix up the school, promised to give her full support in the job if she would accept it, which they did. And she stayed at some people's house by the name of Kennard. And they had a son named Garland Kennard, who later worked at the State National Bank. He's still living in a nursing home down here. But my father lived in the community, and that's how they met.
He lived in at Pleasant?
He lived in Pleasant Ridge.
What did he, was he a farm family there?
He was a farmer. And they met, and not too long after they met, he went away to the Navy. But they became engaged before he went to the Navy. And
now, what year was this about, do you know?
This was about 1918.
So the end of World War One, then. He went into the Navy?
Well, no, it wasn't the end of World War. World War One was still going on. And then when he came back from the Navy, they got married. And his health was bad, though, because during the World War One, there was a big outbreak of the flu, which killed people by the thousands. And he had gotten the flu and double pneumonia with it at the time. And they didn't think he would last to get back to the United States when they sent him home from England. But he recovered, and we moved to Asheville, North Carolina for his health.
What did he do in Asheville?
He had various jobs. He worked delivering newspapers and in the insurance business, things like that. But he wasn't able to do a whole lot. He was supposed to come out of the service with TB from the effects of this double pneumonia and the flu. And we lived there, and I started school there. Went to two different schools. And then we moved back to Kentucky in 1930. It took us 2 days to come from Asheville, North Carolina to Richmond, Kentucky in a Model T Ford.
Was that an adventure, though, for a little boy, wasn't it?
Yeah. I remember stopping at Cumberland Gap cooking breakfast to the side of the road. I remember my mother left her good butcher knife there, which she never did get over. When there was a great big rock that I remember vividly, we climbed that rock, but I never could find that rock again because that road was bypassed when they made the new roads, and I never could locate it. And the people down there in that area evidently didn't remember it either. I don't know whether it was blown up or what, but I always wanted to see that rock.
See that.
But then we came on from Richmond to Germantown, stayed with my grandfather for about a couple or 3 weeks.
What was his name?
His name was Squire Boone.
They called him Squire.
No, his name
was Squire Boone.
Yes. Then we moved to Chatham, and I continued to go to school at Chatham, which was a two-room school. Had to walk every day, 3 miles. And
did your dad go back to farming then at Chatham, or?
Yes. And we set tobacco that year, the 4th of July.
How come so late?
They had a drought, and we got started late. But had a small crop, but it was a very, very severe drought, like this year.
Uh-huh.
And crops didn't amount to too much. Then we moved from Chatham to Fernleaf. I went to school in Minerva, and that's the first time I rode a school bus. We had school buses, and I graduated in Minerva
in 1940. In 1940, so just at the outbreak of World War II then. You said your dad served in the Navy in World War I. Did he ever tell you any stories about it, or what he did, or where he was? Or?
Well, he was stationed in England, and but wasn't too many stories about it. But coming back, they got caught in a storm, and the ship almost turned over. Even the captain gave up hope. He was laying flat on his back with the flu and double pneumonia, and he felt like that was the end of it. But they made it through the storm, but they were 500 miles off course.
500?
When the storm was over. But there's very little to tell because I don't think he was in any of the fighting over there.
What did he do for the Navy? Did he ever say?
I don't know.
Stayed with your grandfather, Squire Boone. What do you remember about him?
Squire Boone was a small man, probably the size of Daniel Boone, and a very quiet man. Farmed all his life, and very religious man, although he was quiet about it. Never missed church. He wasn't a powerful figure in the church, you know what I mean? He didn't do a lot of public praying or anything like that, but he was a very spiritual person. Good man. And well thought of. People today, he's been dead 50 years, people today remember him as a very solid, honest citizen.
It's quite an epitaph.
Yeah. And Squire Boone's father was Levi Boone. That's an old name in the Boone family, too. Levi Boone's father. Well, Levi Boone is buried in Robertson County, in a place called McKendry's Chapel. There's no stone or anything marking his grave. I went over there and tried to get the history of this, but the church records had burned up. And there was a man over there that knew the history, but he died on me. And I didn't get to talk to him. But Levi Boone's father was George Boone.
We go from Squire to Levi to George.
And George Boone, the way I gather it, I have the tree at home, was the son of Edward Boone.
And Edward was the brother of?
Edward was a brother of Daniel. Edward married Martha Bryan, who was a sister to Daniel Boone's wife, Rebecca Boone.
You showed me some papers earlier that said that Edward was married. They thought maybe Edward might have been married twice, but
no.
You don't.
No.
You just the one.
No, I didn't show you any papers that I think.
Well, one of the books in there, I thought it said that he might have, he had two wives. They had a question mark beside the first one. But that's the only wife that you knew of, was Martha.
Yeah, I don't recall seeing anything like that. Yeah. He was killed by the Indians at age 42 on the south side of the Licking River. Daniel and Edward were hunting at the time, and Daniel shot a bear and wounded it, and he went off into the bushes and the cane brakes to finish off the bear. And from what I gather, and according to what I read, Edward Boone was cracking hickory nuts, and the Indian slipped up on him, and they thought they had come upon Daniel. They killed him and beheaded him, and they thought, says, we have killed old Boone at last. And they carried the head back to Little Chillicothe, which today is known as Old Town, north of Zinni, Ohio, on the Little Miami River. But they didn't have Daniel. Daniel came back after he had finished off the bear and saw what the Indians had done to Edward, and they were very close. And he carried him back on his back to Athens, Ohio, which was close to the Boone settlement in Athens, Boone Station, which was established after they had left Fort Boonesboro. And he is now buried about a mile out of Athens, Kentucky, which is between Lexington and Boonesboro.
You said that they thought the boys, they looked so much alike, or were they weren't twins though, were they?
No, they weren't twins, but they looked a lot alike.
You told me earlier a story about Daniel being gone for 2 years, and the brother Edwin fathering a child by Daniel's wife. Is that correct, or am I right on that?
That is what some historians say. And they thought Daniel was dead because he was captured by the Indians and taken to Little Chillicothe and adopted by Kingfish, the chief of the Shawnees at that particular village. And he liked Daniel so well, loved him so well, that he adopted him as his son. And he lived with the Shawnees for 2 years. And each day he would go out hunting for the Indians and bring back game for them, and they allowed him so many bullets to kill the game, which wasn't enough bullets for him to escape with. But he would cut the bullets in half, and he would use, and he'd save half of the bullets. Each day he'd go a little further away, so they would get used to him being gone for a while. And after he had saved up enough ammunition to get him to the fort, he took a long hunt, and it was quite some time before they missed him, so they couldn't be close enough on to him to track him. The reason that he wanted to get away and get back to the fort was because the Shawnees were planning an attack on Fort Boonesboro, and he wanted to get away and warn them of the impending attack. So he made it from the Shawnee village to Fort Boonesboro in 2 days and 2 nights, which was really
moving,
making a lot of time. So he got there and warned the settlers, and they immediately started reinforcing the fort. And if it hadn't been for that, they would have probably been overwhelmed. But they got the fort in readiness and were ready for them, and they sustained the attack. And of course, the British were behind the Indians because they wanted to overthrow the settlers, because it was part of the revolution, and the westward post of the 13 colonies. And a lot of historians claim today that if Fort Boonesboro had fallen at that time, we would probably be under British rule today. But Fort Boonesboro withstood the attack, and the pioneers prevailed in that day.
You know what year that was supposedly took place?
I have a record of it there, but what year it was, but I can't recall right off the top of my head.
What do you know about Edward? Was there much about him outside of his death, or?
There's not a whole lot about Edward.
Did any stories come down through the family about him or at all?
No, I don't know. There's very little about Edward.
Did your grandfather talk about your relationship to Daniel at all, or did you find this out later on in life?
I just studied it myself and read what history had to offer. But my grandfather didn't discuss his heritage very much. My grandfather was a white man.
But you suppose your grandfather was aware that he was a descendant of that?
Yes.
Yeah,
oh, yes.
That was no.
Oh yeah.
Just wasn't anything really that important.
That's just a part of life. It wasn't. They weren't historically minded at that time, like they are today.
Do you remember your grandmother Boone? What she was?
Oh yes.
What was her name? Do you know?
She was a Brownie. And. She was a dark-complected woman. And my grandfather was a light-complected person, like Daniel. And she was a typical pioneer stock. And came from a good family. She lived to be 75. My grandfather lived to be 75 also.
Did your grandmother ever tell you any stories about when she was growing up or what
No.
she did?
My back in those days, your grandfather and your grandmother didn't converse too much with children. It was not like they do today. They didn't show the affection that they do today for children. It was mostly grown-up talk, you know. And today, as a general rule, why grandparents and grandchildren have more camaraderie with each other than they did in pioneer days.
Were your other grandparents alive when you were growing up too? Or?
No, I never saw my grandfather or my grandmother on my mother's side.
So you.
But my grandfather on my mother's side was Price Williams. And my grandmother, her maiden name was Warren.
What was it?
Warren, W-E-A-R-R-I-N, Warren.
Warren.
From Madison County.
Did you spend a lot of time with your grandparents, the Boones? Did you go there for holidays or anything? Or?
My grandfather had a farm about 2 miles back off the road, the main road, and he walked back every day, took his lunch with him, had his old faithful dog, and they walked together, and I went back with him many, many times to drop tobacco plants and help out what I could, you know, when I was a kid. But we had get-togethers on Sundays, you know, like the average family does.
What was a Sunday get-together like?
Just the average talk. But one thing back in the old days, the adults always ate first. The children ate later. Today, they reverse that. They feed the children, get them satisfied, and now the adults eat. You notice that?
Yeah. What did you kids do while the adults were eating then?
Starve to death.
Hoping they'd hurry up?
We had the leftovers.
What was a typical Sunday?
That was typical of all families.
Was it?
Yeah.
Never thought of it that way. Did your grandmother usually make chicken or something like that for Sunday dinner?
Yeah, right. She was a good cook.
Do you have any brothers or sisters?
I have 2 brothers and a sister. I have a brother named William Ralph Boone, and a brother named Orville Emerson Boone, and a sister named Norma Jean Boone, who married a Brayfield. My son is named Donald Sidney Boone. He married a girl by the name of Willa Mason. And I have, they have 2 children. And they're named Brian Edward Boone after the Edward Boone that I descended from, and Edward's wife, Brian, from the Bryan family. Her last name was Martha Bryan. So that's 2 names from the descendants. And my granddaughter is named Rebecca Jane. Rebecca's after Daniel's wife, Rebecca Bryan. And Jane is from my wife. Her middle name is Jane.
Oh, I didn't know that was Thelma's middle
Jane.
Name. Thelma Jane.
I have another son named Kenneth Eugene Boone.
Is Kenneth,
no children.
I was going to say, is Kenneth married?
He's married, but no children.
I've never met him, so. you grew up in the times of the Depression.
Oh, yeah.
Did the Depression of the 30s affect your family greatly, or did it make much of an impression on you as a child growing up?
We didn't know any better. We just lived like the average poor family during the Depression. We never went hungry, but we didn't have anything either. We didn't have a radio. All through my high school, we didn't have a radio. The only means of international communication or national communication that we had was through the papers and pamphlets that the school took.
Most of the children you grew up with were in the same situation, weren't they?
Yeah, most of them were. Well, I wouldn't say poor, but we, by today's standards, we were poor. We didn't have any money whatsoever, but we had food and decent clothes.
Well, your mom grew a garden, didn't she?
Oh yeah, we had a garden, and my mother canned everything she could can. We picked blackberries by the hundreds of gallons, raspberries, things like that. At that time, you couldn't sell blackberries. I had tried to sell 3-gallon buckets of blackberries for a quarter, and nobody'd buy them.
Nobody had a quarter to buy them with?
Nobody had a quarter to buy them with, or if they did, they didn't want to buy them.
Now, with your brothers and sister, where did you fall in the family? Were you the oldest or middle?
No,
or?
My oldest brother died when he was 2 years and a half old from membrane croup, which was a quick-acting diphtheria. And today he could have been saved.
Yeah.
But at that time, it came on quick and he just choked to death. But the ironic part of it was there was a train stalled on the tracks and the doctor couldn't get to him.
Oh, no.
And my mother died a year and a half ago at age 93, and she never did get over it. And the second child in our family was my brother William R. Boone, and I was the third, and Barbara was the fourth, and Norma was the fifth.
Were you kids close growing up?
Pretty close as far as families are concerned. We fought a little, but all boys do.
Yeah. What did you guys like to do to have a good time when you were growing up?
Oh, just walk about 2 or 3 miles to go swimming.
Where'd you swim?
In the creeks, in the pools.
I'll say there's not much water in Kentucky Creek, so at least
no.
Around this area.
Well, there was then.
Oh, was there?
There was much more water in the creeks then than there is today. Creeks that I swam in and fished in and caught pretty good fish in back then are pretty well dry today. We're going through a dry decade. Well, several decades, the water level of the whole country is going down.
But when you were growing up, they were all full of water, mostly year-round then?
Pretty much so.
Yeah.
We did everything that didn't cost anything. We hunted, and we fished, and walked. Rolled a hoop.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't own a bicycle. We were never able to afford a bicycle. We rode the neighbor's horses.
The neighbor's horses?
And sit around and watch the grass grow.
That's a good occupation for young kids. Did you celebrate Christmas at home when you were growing up? How did you celebrate it?
We just got up early on Christmas Day and had very meager presents, but we always had. Well, I can remember when I was in third grade in Chatham for Christmas. I got a high top boots for Christmas, and it had a pocket on the side of the boots with a knife in it. And I thought that was the greatest thing.
That would have been.
There was.
Yeah. Did you all have a Christmas tree?
Oh, yes. We always had a Christmas tree.
Did you go out and cut it down, or did
we
you buy
it? We had to cut it down with it. You didn't buy trees back in those days. You didn't have the money to buy the tree with. And you searched the country, but you got a cedar tree because there was plenty of cedars. There wasn't any spruces or pines or anything like that in this country.
How'd you decorate your tree? Did you have store-bought decorations, or did you make
them?
Well,
I had a few. But sometimes we'd pop the corn and string it, things like that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't elaborately decorated, we'll put it that way.
Yeah, but it was something you all had done.
Very, very exciting, very enjoyable. It didn't take too much to make a person happy back in those days. Mm-hmm. Today, people are so used to all luxuries of life that it takes much more to make them happy or experience joy than it did back in the old days. A small trinket was great joy back then.
Did you have, you said you had apples and oranges, did you hang your stockings in at night? What'd your mother, what was usually what you have on the table for Christmas dinner?
We'd usually have country ham and everything that went with it, mashed potatoes, gravy, green beans, and things like that. Country ham at that time was cured by people that knew how to cure country ham. The old masters at curing country hams are all dead. But country ham back in those days was a great delicacy that modern Kentuckians, very few have experienced.
How was it different than the way they cure them today, do you know?
It just had more flavor and aroma. When you fried a country ham, of course, during Christmas, we'd have baked country ham. When you fried country ham in the morning, you could smell it for a half a mile. It smells so good. Made red-eye gravy. Today, with the quick-cured hams that they have, you can stick your nose down in the skillet and you can't smell it. It has no flavor. The art of curing country hams is lost through the commercialization of giving a quick cure to get it on the market.
Did your dad ever, did he cure his own hams, or did...
Yes.
You remember watching him do it, how he did it?
I don't know the exact recipe, but I know that they, as soon as they killed the meat, they put salt on it, kept it on so many days, and then they removed the salt, and then they put pepper. opinions on it. But I know one thing, my father could cure a country ham that would melt in your mouth.
Did they smoke them at all, or did they just hang them up?
He smoked lightly.
You know,
sometimes he smoked them, sometimes he didn't, but either way, his hams were excellent.
Was there a particular time of the year that he would kill the hogs, or did he?
Well, you have to wait till the weather gets cold enough so the meat won't spoil. And it has to be cold enough that it'll take salt before the weather gets hot. That was one problem that the pioneers in Kentucky had, was an adequate supply of salt to cure their meat. They had to continually kill fresh meat to keep in stock meat. And the salt supply around Blue Licks, around Boonesboro, wasn't adequate enough to salt cure the meat. That's why they went to Blue Licks and boiled down the salt in big kettles, and then would transport it back to Harrodsburg and Boonesboro to cure their meat. That's when they were captured. At one time was when they were boiling down the water to get the salt to cure the meat.
Now here at Mays Licks, they did the same thing. There was big kettles, I understand, here at Mays Lick doing the same thing. You know, you said taking the salt. What do you mean by taking it?
Well, the water was so salty that they would fill a big kettle and build a fire under it and boil it down. And when they got done, when they boiled all the water out of it, in the bottom they'd have quite a bit of salt. And they'd take that salt out and put it in bags, and then they'd boil another kettle down. And it took days, you know, to get enough salt to transport back for their use in curing their meat.
Well, you were talking about your dad. You said that they had to do it in the cold when the meat would take the salt. What do you mean by that? It would stick to it, or would it absorb
no,
it?
No, you just lay the salt on top of the meat, and then you have to turn it over. But they didn't wait till it got too cold either. You didn't want your meat to freeze. But they had meat houses, and when the weather got down to where it was cold enough where the meat wouldn't spoil real easy, that's when they, it was usually in November when they killed meat.
Did your dad kill beef too, or mostly?
No. When we were in Chatham, they had a beef club. And this was during the Depression, 1930. They formed this club, so many people, and they would kill a beef each weekend. There was no refrigeration at that time, and you had to get your meat on Saturday afternoon for your weekend meal. And they would kill this beef on Saturday, divide the meat up among the club members, and that way you had beef on the weekend. And they would take turns about the different cuts of meat. If you got a chuck roast this week, you might be entitled to a rump roast next weekend. See, and they didn't let one particular person get the choice cuts of meat each week. It took turns about, which worked out very good. But I have never ever heard of a beef club since 1930 when we had that down there.
Did your dad pay dues into it, or?
Well, they each paid so much, whatever the cost of the beef was.
And there was no way then for your mother to keep it past the weekend. I mean, you
no.
either ate it then or you didn't.
You ate it. then.
So every weekend you would have beef, yeah. And then the rest of the week, what would you have, chicken and pork, or what else?
Eat a lot of chicken. Everybody raised their own chickens at that time. Today, farmers don't raise any chickens, but we always raised our own chickens. And they ran around, you know, and ate lots of grasshoppers and crickets and so forth, and green grass, and the eggs that they produced had bright yellow yolk in it due to the fact that they ate a lot of chlorophyll, which is in grass and green, which your commercial chicken factories don't have. That's why the yellows are so pale. They don't have any chlorophyll. And whenever we would want chicken, my mother would just go out. We'd run a chicken down. She'd wring its neck and have the water boiling. And she could pick a chicken, or we could pick a chicken in no time, you know, and have that chicken on frying. And that chicken that was raised like that, of course, we fed corn to the chickens too to give it flavor.
Yeah.
Corn will give chicken, beef, pork, their flavor better than any grain that you can feed it. So those chickens we had back in those days was much more delicious than the chickens today that you buy off the supermarket shelf.
It sounded like they'd be good and fat chickens.
Well, they were tasty. They would melt in your mouth. Of course, my mother was a good cook, and boy, I tell you, when she put out a fried chicken dinner, why, it was fine eating.
Your mom, did she cook 3 big meals a day?
Yes, she did. She had a wood and coal stove, got up and built a fire in it every morning, made biscuits every morning, made biscuits 3 times a day. Light bread, as we call it in those days, was a delicacy that you got maybe once a month.
Now
baker's bread.
Are you talking about like loaf bread?
Yeah. But my mother also made homemade yeast rolls and homemade bread, which today is, to me, is more of a delicacy than commercial bread. And my mother could make as good a homemade yeast rolls as I ever ate in my life.
You're making me hungry. I get to
After I graduated, I went to Dayton, Ohio, and I'd used to come in on weekends, and every Friday night she'd have a big bunch of homemade yeast rolls made up with plenty of butter. I'd eat about a dozen.
I bet you would.
Believe it or not.
I think I'd probably fought you for some of them. Something I was going to ask. You graduated from high school then, you say, and you went on to Dayton. What'd you do in Dayton, Ohio?
I worked for National Cash Register Company. My first job that I got when I went to Dayton was with a little hamburger place called White Clock. They sold hamburgers for a nickel. A cup of coffee was a nickel. Piece of pie was a nickel. Chili, bowl of chili was a dime. And the main thing, I rented a room for $3 a week. And the main thing was I got to eat all the hamburgers I wanted, which sustained me while I was trying to get a job at National Cash Register Company, which was considered the best place in Dayton to work.
How come you went to Dayton? How come you didn't go to Louisville or Lexington? Or?
I just heard that National Cash Register was a good place to work and decided to go over there.
When you finally got on with them, what was your job with them?
I started as a messenger boy.
How old were you when you left?
18.
You didn't stay a messenger boy, though, did you?
No. It was almost impossible to get a job at National Cash Register. The waiting room would be full every day, people seeking jobs. And I went every day for 2 months and a half before I got a job. The man told me, he said, "Now this is not much of a job, but," he said, "at least you'll be in." And he said, "When something opens up, you can go on up," which I did. I got many promotions. They were one of the finest companies to work for in the United States at that time.
What year was it that you went to work for?
1941.
The outbreak of the war, then.
No, I went in January. I went in January 1941. War started December 7th, 1941.
Where were you when you heard about Pearl Harbor?
I was with my girlfriend sitting in the car in Brooksville, Kentucky.
What did you think when that came on?
Well, I was pretty well stunned, like everybody else.
Do you know where Hawaii was?
Oh, yeah. I had a good education. I'd say that our high school education at that time was more complete than the average high school education today. We had excellent teachers.
Well, I wasn't disparaging it. I mean, you know, Pearl Harbor, I would have thought, wasn't a place that was on everybody's lips before the world started, war started. Were you involved in World War II at all, or?
No, I was, I volunteered for the Navy in 1943, and I was rejected, and I was also rejected from the Army after they had kept me a week in Fort Thomas in the Army hospital, put me on a liquid diet of skim milk and pineapple juice, trying to get a blood test on me. I had so much excess cholesterol, they couldn't get this blood test on me. So at that time, they didn't know too much about cholesterol. So they knew that I had too much. So they didn't want to take a chance on me, so they rejected me.
With World War II, business picked up in the United States. Were you still with NCR then?
Yeah, I was with them 7 years. That's where I met my wife.
That one worked for him too?
Yeah, and her father worked for him 47 years. He was a first-class stationary engineer. He was in charge of all of the water supply for the company, and he was in charge of all the refrigeration for the company. All of her people worked at NCR at one time or other.
What'd Thelma do for them?
She did office work at times, and then she worked on a assembly line testing M43 mechanical time fuses. The building that we were in manufactured M43 mechanical time fuses that went on the end of these big ballistic missiles, and they were timed to go off the time of impact, and they were built almost like a watch. And the part that I had was grinding brass plates that went in the M43 mechanical time fuse. And then she was in the final testing, and her job ran out of work, and they moved her down close to where I was, and
that's how you met her.
I saw her, and I saw, I liked what I saw.
I can see why you would.
We eventually started going together.
Was NCR into war materials before the war?
No. But they immediately started into war work and went in war work 100%. They won the Army Navy E for excellence in war production. Immediately after the war, they went back into production of cash registers, payroll machines, and so forth, but they were a little bit slow in getting into the computer business, and they had some bad times because IBM got hit of them. The computer end of it, but they eventually caught up, and today NCR has a big place in the computer business today, like in supermarkets. They drag this merchandise over, and this computer thing reads the code on it.
Yeah.
NCR produces all those. And gives you an instant printout. Tells you what the merchandise is, like a can of beans, 50 cents, just by dragging this code over this little light.
When were you and Thelma married then?
March 18th, 1944.
So you all got married before the end of the war, and you stayed with the NCR then through the war?
I stayed with NCR until 1948. Then I resigned and moved back to Kentucky. I wanted to come back to Kentucky.
Kentuckians happen to want to come back to Kentucky a lot. Where'd you all go then when you came back?
Well, when I came back to Kentucky, I moved in with my father in Dover, Kentucky. He had a big old brick home. And I stayed there for 6 months until I could rent a place. And in the meantime, I'd gotten a job with the Western Southern Life Insurance Company.
And you stayed with them until you retired, didn't you?
I stayed with them 31 years until I retired.
When did you two move to Maze Lick?
I moved to Maze Lick, and I lived in Maysville about 25 years. Prior to that, I lived 4 years at Rectorville, which I had 4 acres of ground out there and a house. But I wanted to get back out in the country where it was quiet because there was so much traffic there in town. So we came out to Maze Lick and found a lot and built a house in 1971.
From 1971 to today, 88, have you seen a lot of changes in Maze Lick, or has it pretty well stayed the same?
Not much. It's pretty well stayed the same outside of a little building in the area where I live. That's the only change in Maze Lick.
Had you ever come to Maze Lick prior to moving out here? I mean, had you had much dealings with the town, or?
No, because the road to Maze Lick from Maysville was so winding, it took better than a half hour to go to Maze Lick. There wasn't that much there to go out there for. The only thing that you would go through Maze Lick for would be to go to Lexington. There was no interest in anybody going to Maze Lick, because there was nothing here. But then they built the new road, and that's the only reason that I would have built at Maze Lick, was because it cut the driving time from a half an hour down to about 13 minutes.
Yeah.
And I figured that it was far out enough that I wouldn't have people building up by the side of me real soon. Most of the subdivisions down around Maysville were small lots, and people were too close together, and I wanted to get out where I had a little elbow room, like Daniel Boone did.
You've got quite a good size lot at your place.
Got about an acre.
Yeah, so you're not really crowded with a lot of people. When did the houses around you start going up then?
Johnny Doyle was first house built there. Christian Church Parsonage was the second house, and I was the third house, and I built mine right after the Christian Church built theirs.
I've had other people tell me that the road, the new highway 68, was what caused the town to go down as far as businesses moving out and everything, because people could get to Maysville earlier, but you think that 68
no
coming
business.
In and help build
there
it up?
There was no business in Mays Lick before the road went in. It's been pretty stable ever since I've known Mays Lick. It's been about the same. Mays Lick was much more flourishing 100 years ago than it is today.
Yeah, that's no doubt about that.
But that didn't affect Mays Lick any, but the town bypassing them.
The road, you mean?
Yeah. I mean the road bypassing them.
Town might have bypassed them, too. Why come you would have chosen Mays Lick over some of the other small towns? How come you didn't go back to Minerva or some of the others around
Well,
here?
Minerva was out of the way. There was no main arteries going to Minerva. Everything was moving south. And that's why
I moved this way.
Yeah. Now, when I lived in Maysville, whenever I wanted to go to town, I'd go to Cincinnati. But since I moved to Mays Lick, I'm closer to Lexington. I go to Lexington more than I do Cincinnati. I hardly ever go to Cincinnati anymore.
Have you noticed a lot of changes in the 25 years you lived in Maysville? Did that change a lot, or is it
quite a bit of change in Maysville?
You think it was good change or bad or indifferent?
No, I think a lot of change was for the better. They have a county park system, which is. Would have been a wonderful thing for me when I was younger. They have the community college, which would have been a wonderful thing for me and my children, which came too late for us. Growth of industry, which helped people get better jobs. There was no jobs when I came back to Maysville, and now they through DuVoe and DP&L Power Plant, East Kentucky Power, and other industries, why there's more opportunities for people. And the roads have improved in and out of Maysville, although we still need some improvement, like bridge.
Yeah, working on that.
But I think Maysville has improved for the better.
As an I've never really interviewed anyone who's been in insurance. Over the years you were with the insurance company, did you see a lot of changes in insurance or people's awareness of it? Or?
Well, it was a pretty slow change. 1948 until I retired, it was a gradual change. People were buying more insurance in 1978 than they were in 1948, larger policies and more of it. But there was a much bigger change after I left. Due to the interest rate change, the insurance companies had to compete with the banks and so forth for the dollar, so they had to come out with different policies, which gave a more favorable return on the interest rate, like a universal life policy, which was more flexible than the older insurance policies.
When you first started out in 48, were people really even interested? Or did they think they needed insurance? Today, so many people.
Well, yeah, they knew they needed insurance. They needed insurance long before that, because Western Southern was established in 1888. One of the oldest towns that they were in was Maysville, but it was on a smaller scale. People at that time thought more in terms of providing last expenses in the way of burials, whereas today